van in a shot and races to the house, no doubt thinking about her once promising career every step of the way. Holding her phone, Elizabeth realizes she will be straight off for questioning as soon as the troops arrive, and that won't be long. Her phone will be taken off her, the photographs deleted. She scans the front garden walls of St. Albans Avenue until she sees what she needs two houses up. The driver has run into the house, so Elizabeth takes a brisk walk, dislodges a loose brick from the low wall, slides her mobile phone into the gap, and then replaces the brick. The perfect dead letter drop. So, now there are diamonds and killers to be found. Part 2. At times, you won't believe your eyes. Chapter 30. Patrice is on half term and is staying with Chris. Chris still can't quite get used to it. He is pretending to eat healthily, which, after a couple of days, he realizes is the same as actually eating healthily. An apple is an apple, whether you are eating it because you like to take care of yourself or you are eating it to impress a new girlfriend. The nutrients are the same. Chris hasn't had a Snickers since Monday. Tonight, they had been due to go to Le Pont Noir for dinner. Formerly a dive called the Black Bridge, it is now Fairhaven's leading, if only, gastropub. On Tuesdays, they have a jazz trio playing in the dining room. Chris has never enjoyed jazz, never even quite worked out which bit he was supposed to be enjoying, but he does know that people who like jazz seem to enjoy life, and that he needs to pretend to enjoy life a bit more than he does. And what if it's the same as apples? What if pretending to enjoy life is the same as actually enjoying it? He has been smiling from the moment Patrice arrived, so perhaps there was something in it. Patrice got things from him too, he knew that. He could objectively see that he was kind and funny. He had a proper job catching criminals. Anything else? He had been told he had nice eyes. He was a good kisser. Everything else could be covered up for now. Don't run before you can walk, Chris. And do all women tell all men they are good kissers? Chris supposes so. What does it cost them? The call from Donna came at around 6:30. Ryan Baird had been arrested and was on his way to Fairhaven Police Station. No jazz for Chris, which was a relief. That new leaf could wait. Patrice had been very understanding. Suspiciously understanding, in fact. What if Patrice didn't like jazz either? What if they were both pretending? That was something to explore. It would certainly be an enormous relief. Chris had driven to the station, interviewed Ryan Baird, who had screamed blue murder about being framed by a plumber, and had eventually been charged with possession with intent to supply, as well as robbery and led to a cell. His solicitor looked a little perkier than last time, too, so either he enjoyed seeing Ryan being sent down, or he, too, had escaped an evening of jazz. Chris had texted Patrice, and they are now sitting in the snug of Le Pont Noir, the only evidence of the evening's jazz, a solitary drumstick on a walnut bar stool. Chris and Patrice are together on a leather sofa, and opposite them, legs tucked underneath her in a deep armchair, is Donna, Chris's partner, Patrice's daughter. "The Thursday Murder Club?" asks Patrice. "There's four of them," says Donna. "Ibrahim was the one who had his phone stolen. Ron was the plumber. And who got hold of 10 grand's worth of coke?" Donna looks at Chris. "I'm guessing Elizabeth?" Chris nods. "I'd have thought so. I mean, never rule out Joyce." "But isn't it all illegal?" "Very." And wouldn't you get into trouble if it came out?
Mum, says Donna, I got a call from a plumber saying he'd found cocaine and a stolen bank card at the flat. There were screams. I went to the flat and found the cocaine and the bank card. I arrested the youth present at the scene. Chris and I questioned him. He denied all charges.
Which they often do, says Chris.
Which they often do. We felt there was sufficient evidence to charge him, and so we charged him.
And what about when it comes to court, when they call this plumber as a witness and he isn't a plumber?
Donna shrugs. I'm guessing Elizabeth will have thought of that. Patrice raises her whiskey glass and the ice cubes tinkle in salute.
They sound like a hell of a gang. I'd love to meet them.
We're keeping you a secret for now, says Chris.
Are we? Says Patrice, stretching a leg across Chris's lap.
I'm involved about as much as I want to be with the Thursday Murder Club. If they can plant cocaine in someone's cistern, I don't want to think about what they do with my love life.
Cue, you said love life and not sex life, says Patrice.
Don't say sex, Mum, says Donna. Stop showing off.
I meant my personal life, says Chris.
Too late. You said it now, says Patrice.
That lot would have us married in weeks, says Chris.
How awful, says Patrice with an eyebrow raised.
Mum, stop pretending you want to marry Chris just because you've had two whiskies. Don't make me regret introducing you two.
Have you heard from Elizabeth, by the way? Chris asks Donna.
Not a peep, says Donna, checking her phone. You'd think she'd be loving this, Ryan Baird in custody.
Chris looks at his watch.
Well, it's 10:30, you know that lot. She'll be tucked up in bed by now.
Talking of which, says Patrice, looking straight at Chris and playing with her necklace.
Oh, God, Mum, puke, says Donna,
and finishes her whiskey with a shake of the head.
Chapter 31. So let's see what Elizabeth Best has got, shall we? The great hero of the service. Is she all she's cracked up to be? Sue Reardon can't help but compare herself to the woman sitting directly across from her. Elizabeth Best. Silver hair and tweed jacket. Face impassive. What does she know? Or what is she willing to tell? They have both killed people in their time, for good reasons, of course, but they've still done it. That creates a kinship and a respect, but also a suspicion. Elizabeth has every trick in the book, and Sue Reardon will need a few of her own to get what she needs. So be it. The room is small, as they so often are. Claustrophobia, that's the idea. The walls are metal-plated up to waist height and concrete above that. It has no windows but cameras in each corner. The thick walls muffle the conversation. It looks like it would survive a nuclear explosion, and indeed that's exactly what it has been designed to do. Lance James is pacing at the far wall.
Keep still, for goodness sake! It's not helping anyone, says Elizabeth.
Sorry, says Lance. Lance James is not the sort of man to sit still when he can stand and pace instead. He was seconded to Sue from the special boat service, but she knows little else about him. He's quiet and he's hardworking, and that will do Sue just fine. He is in his early 40s and clinging on gamely to his medium to good looks. The already thinning blonde hair, however, will soon thin further and grey and then disappear altogether. A life of small rooms, stakeouts, late nights and stress. Sue has seen many a handsome man go south over the years. She gives Lance 5 years at most.
She had sat with Elizabeth and her friend Joyce in the back of a windowless van for the whole journey here. They had then been blindfolded as they were walked to this room. This was all to disguise their destination, but Elizabeth would know exactly where they were. Godalming. The house, they called it, in the isolation cells 3 floors below ground. She knows Elizabeth will have interviewed people in this very room during her time at MI5. She would have been sitting in Sue's seat. It had been given a spruce up since then, some new grey paint on the ceiling. No cameras in those days either, which was probably best for all concerned.
"You don't hear of many Lances these days," says Joyce. "Is it a family name?"
"Afraid so," says Lance. Sue can see that Joyce has been thrilled by the whole experience. She had nodded off in the van while Elizabeth was, no doubt, keeping track of time and direction. But she had particularly enjoyed the blindfolding.
"Well, I can tell we're going up in a lift now," she had said on their way down to this subterranean floor.
Lance leans back against the wall and folds his arms across his muscular chest. "So you received a message from Douglas Middlemiss," says Sue. "Let's start there, shall we? What time would that have been exactly?"
"I don't know," says Elizabeth.
She won't want to give everything away, or anything away if she can help it. "That's fine, softly, softly."
"And can you show us the message?" asks Sue, politeness itself.
Sue is always polite in interrogations. The angry ones run out of patience long before you do.
"I'm afraid not. It's on my phone."
"And where is your phone?" asks Sue. "It wasn't in your bag, which we found strange."
"Oh, we don't carry our phones everywhere, Sue," says Joyce. "Purse, keys, a bit of makeup just in case, and a bag for life. That's all you really need."
Sue nods at Joyce. "It's a double act, is it? I need to keep an eye on this Joyce too. What a tiny, formidable woman. Exactly the sort of woman you'd want parachuted behind enemy lines with a gun and a cipher machine." She turns back to Elizabeth.
"I wonder where it is then, Elizabeth."
"Well, I wish I could remember," says Elizabeth.
"You don't remember where your phone is," says Lance from behind her. "About time he piped up."
"I'm afraid not."
"It comes to us all, dear," says Elizabeth.
"I once searched the whole flat for mine," says Joyce. "Honestly, 20 minutes it must have taken, and it was in my hand all along."
"I wouldn't wish it on you, Lance," says Elizabeth. "Cherish your youth." Lance finally leaves the wall. He walks over and takes a seat next to Sue Reardon. Sue leans forward and addresses Elizabeth directly.
"I'm guessing it's at your flat."
"One would imagine so," agrees Elizabeth. Sue gives a satisfied nod.
"That does sound the most likely, doesn't it? So you'll be comfortable with me sending a team over to search for it?"
"Aren't the rules these days that everything has to be left immaculate after a search?" asks Elizabeth.
"Those were always the rules," says Lance.
"Yes, but now you actually have to abide by them. European Court of Justice sticking their oar in."
"Everything will be left immaculate," says Sue. "What's on that phone? Messages? Photographs?"
"Well, in that case, you go right ahead. It needs a tidy," says Elizabeth.
"That will be fun for Stephen, a team of goons in the flat at the dead of night. He's a fine host."
"She might even have left it with me," says Joyce.
"If you want to give my flat a once over too. Especially the bathroom."
"In the absence of the phone for now, can you remember what the message said?" asks Sue, the exact words. Elizabeth nods and recites from memory. Poppy and I have been moved to 38 St. Albans Avenue, Hove. I would be obliged if you would meet me there. There is something I want to show you. So you can remember the exact words of the message, says Lance, but not where your phone is. Elizabeth taps her head. My palace has many rooms. Some are dustier than others. Sue notices that Lance can't hide a little smile. These two are a piece of work, all right. Sue nods again. You poor thing, ma'am. That must be dreadful. And that was the whole message? Nothing else? Well, it also said, come alone, but I thought Joyce would enjoy it. Thank you, says Joyce. I did. Up to a point. And do you have any idea of what he wanted to show you? Elizabeth pauses. She looks up at the cameras. As she looks back at Sue Reardon, she makes up her mind. Honestly, I assumed he wanted to show me the diamonds. You think he had the diamonds with him? What else could it be? Asks Elizabeth. That's assuming he stole the diamonds in the first place, says Lance. And we have no evidence of that. Well, says Elizabeth, and I realise I probably should have passed this on before now, but I know he stole them. He told me. When did he tell you this, Elizabeth? Asks Sue, still calm. Oh, a few days ago, perhaps, says Elizabeth. Sue is unsurprised. Of course Douglas told her. He trusted her. He loved her. But he didn't have the diamonds with him at the safe house, Elizabeth. He'd been searched before he got there, while he was there, and after someone blew his head off. So what else might he have wanted to show you? Perhaps he wanted to show Elizabeth a key or a code or a riddle, says Joyce, to let her know where the diamonds were. I can't do riddles at all. What's the one about the man who can only lie and the man who can only tell the truth? Sue realises that Joyce is waiting for an answer, so gives her an I'm as baffled as you, Joyce, shrug. That's very good, Joyce, says Elizabeth. And now, of course, whoever killed Douglas and Poppy, let's assume Martin Lomax, will have that information instead, riddle or not, so Martin Lomax can get his diamonds back. Perhaps Martin Lomax isn't the only person with a motive for shooting Douglas and Poppy, though, says Joyce. Of course, says Sue. All that money, 20 million, we'd all like it, wouldn't we? Joyce adds. There is a general agreement that they would. It's out there somewhere, but where? And, as Elizabeth will tell you, there were two people in the house the night that the diamonds were stolen, Joyce goes on, Douglas and Lance. And I think we're taking Lance's word a bit too easily. I mean no offence by this, Lance, but we don't know you one bit, do we? Who's to say you didn't see Douglas steal the diamonds and you've been looking for a chance to get your hands on them? Well, I wasn't going to say that out loud, says Elizabeth. But now the cork is out of the bottle and since we're being filmed, it's worth discussing. Discuss away, says Lance. I have nothing to hide. Almost certainly not, agrees Elizabeth. But you were in the house on the evening of the theft. You knew where Douglas and Poppy were being kept. You probably appointed Poppy to this job in the first place, an unusual appointment. So perhaps you were even in league with her, says Joyce. Total conjecture, of course, says Elizabeth, but I trust this will all be investigated. Oh, it will all be investigated, says Sue. This is more like it. Lance will quite rightly be a suspect, and I will add another suspect to the list. Probably the only other person who knew that Douglas was at Cooper's Chase and at St. Albans Avenue. A confidant and an ex-wife of the dead man. A woman trained in breaking and entering, a woman trained in killing, a woman who has, conveniently, mislaid her mobile phone. She would be a suspect, too, don't you think?
She certainly would, agrees Elizabeth. As would you, of course, Sue. I imagine you have every skill I had, and a few more they've thought up in the meantime.
Let's say you suspected that Douglas had stolen the diamonds.
Let's say that, yes, confirms Sue. She's happy now the conversation is opening up a bit, a chance to observe Elizabeth a little better, start to read her.
Or let's say you already knew. Let's say you and Douglas were more than colleagues. You wouldn't be the first person Douglas has seduced.
Let's say not everyone would make the same mistake you made, says Sue.
Interesting line of attack from Elizabeth.
Touché, says Elizabeth. But £20 million suddenly swimming around, and only one man knows where it is, that might be tempting.
I should think so, says Sue. Very tempting.
And you, of course, would have had ample opportunity to kill Douglas and Poppy. You knew where they were. You would have access. You would have their trust. You were in charge of putting them there, and, no doubt, you'll be in charge of cleaning up the mess.
Sue nods. I'm beginning to wish I had thought of this now, aren't you?
I think I might have thought of a way of doing this without killing anyone, though, says Elizabeth.
I hope you might extend me the professional courtesy of imagining that I might have too, says Sue. I worked with Douglas for nearly 20 years.
My condolences, says Elizabeth.
Now, while we agree that anyone in this room, other than Joyce, might have murdered Douglas, it does feel that a trip to see Mr. Lomax might be in order.
Under no circumstances are you to visit Martin Lomax, says Sue. We'll be dealing with him.
Of course, says Elizabeth. Don't visit Martin Lomax. We must try to remember that, Joyce.
Joyce nods. Understood.
Now, Elizabeth, says Sue, you said Douglas wanted to show you something.
I did say that.
Well, we found this in his jacket pocket.
Sue reaches into an evidence bag and pulls out a silver locket. It has a mirror inside, nothing else.
Will it mean anything to Elizabeth? I wonder if this was what he wanted to show you.
She sees that Elizabeth recognizes it immediately. Well, of course.
It's inscribed with your name.
Elizabeth picks up the locket. She weighs it in her hand and flicks it open to see the mirror.
Sue sees that she is thinking, and she knows what Elizabeth is thinking too.
Sue smiles at her.
Very touching, Elizabeth. He must have loved you very much.
In his way, agrees Elizabeth.
You lucky thing, says Sue. The love of a good man. Or a man, at the very least.
Elizabeth smiles to herself.
Now it's midnight, says Sue, and you have beds to go to.
And Sue still has one more job to do this evening. Not a pleasant one, but an important one. Lance leads Joyce and Elizabeth from the room. Sue will be sticking close to them from now on.
Chapter 32. Joyce. Have I ever spoken about Maureen Gilkes? I suspect not, no offence to her. She lives in Ruskin Court. Her husband was in motorbikes, and she sometimes comes collecting for the British Heart Foundation shop.
I once gave her a blouse, and when I was next in Fairhaven, I saw it in the shop, which was a thrill. I sent a photo to Joanna, but she just replied, "Well, what do you think they were going to do with it, Mum?" Anyway, next time I went down there, it was gone, which was also lovely, though I had nothing to take a photo of that time. Well, Maureen Gilkes has a nephew called Daniel or David, and he is an actor. The way Maureen tells it, he is doing very well, though I haven't seen him in anything, not even a Morse. A couple of years ago now, this nephew had a hair transplant. Have you heard of them? I saw Dr. Range talking about them on This Morning once. They take hair from the back of your head and put it on the top of your head, and hey presto, you're not going bald anymore. Apparently, it worked an absolute treat, and Daniel looks 10 years younger, and there's no way you would ever know. This is all according to Maureen, by the way, so don't take my word for it. Actually, this is probably not where I should have started this diary entry, so let me backtrack a moment. I'm quite tired. Douglas and Poppy are dead. Elizabeth and I went to Hove, which, I have to say, was busier than I'd expected for a Tuesday. Does nobody go to work anymore? Douglas had wanted to show Elizabeth something. We walked into a house on St. Albans Avenue near the King Alfred swimming pool, and there they were, shot dead. Douglas is fair game, I think, but how awful about Poppy. I'm afraid it has left me very sad. Even though I try not to get too sad these days. She was in my living room 3 days ago. How unfair to die in your 20s with all that fun ahead of you. The kisses and the boat rides and the flowers and the new coats. Those poems she will never read to a new lover. You will go completely mad waiting for life to be fair, but whoever killed Poppy took something beautiful. Poppy's mum, Siobhan, was supposed to visit today, and I was very worried that I was the one who was going to have to tell her about the murder. But as she's Poppy's next of kin, she was told straight away and is going down to identify the body, poor woman. She sent me a message, and the message ended with emojis of a poppy and a daisy, which was very moving. I sent one back, telling her we would still like to see her, and I tried to add a poppy and a daisy to that too, but I pressed the wrong thing and sent a poppy and a Christmas tree instead. I hope she will understand. So, we have 2 murders on our hands, 3 if you count Andrew Hastings, but we already know who did that. Every time I walk into a bedroom these days, someone has been shot. I was going to plump up the pillows in the spare room earlier, but got cold feet. I don't think we will be able to have fun with Sue and Lance the way we have fun with Chris and Donna and the Fairhaven police. It's a shame. I'm sure we'll try our best, though. We often wear people down in the end. Speaking of Lance, that's why I was talking about Maureen Gilkes and her nephew. You can see that Lance's hair is thinning, and I kept thinking that I should mention hair transplants to him. You could tell he was exactly the sort of man whose hair was very important to him. I kept waiting for a lull in the conversation or a bit of small talk, but the right moment didn't come. Every time there was a pause and I thought, well, here goes, Sue would mention something about Poppy's gunshot wounds or the blood splattered behind Douglas's head. I simply didn't get the chance. So I do hope I see Lance again, because it is best to catch these things as early as possible. That's what Maureen Gilkes said. Let me quickly Google her nephew. Okay, I'm back. Nothing. I tried Daniel Gilkes, actor, and David Gilkes, actor, and he was nowhere to be seen. So maybe I have his first name wrong. Also, he may not be a Gilkes. So I don't know his first name or his surname, and I'm not good enough at Google to overcome that. By the way, I messaged Nigella on Instagram about her sausages in black treacle. She has yet to reply, but I know she's here, there and everywhere, so she's forgiven.
I also posted my first photo, just of the postbox, and someone called at Sparkly Rock Girl replied, "Nice pic," and followed me. So now I have a follower. We all have to start somewhere.
I wonder if Elizabeth is sad about Douglas. I've never had an ex-husband, so I wouldn't know.
I could see she didn't much like him, though Elizabeth doesn't much like most people, but she doesn't go around marrying them all. Douglas still loved her, you could see that. And he had her locket in his jacket, which was very touching. So she must be sad. And she can't talk to Stephen about things anymore, least of all this. At least I have Joanna to talk to. I will text her in the morning and tell her I've seen three corpses and been blindfolded and interrogated by MI5. Recently, my gossip has been so-and-so has cataracts or a fox got into the hen house. I hear her drifting and I don't blame her. I won't tell her about the 20 million, though. I don't know why. Well, I do know why. She will have an opinion, and I'm not in the mood for Joanna's opinions. Imagine if we found the diamonds. I'm not saying that we will. I'm just saying imagine. Martin Lomax will probably find them, probably already has, or MI5 will find them, or the Mafia. But let's say, for one moment, that Elizabeth, Ron, Ibrahim and I find them. You never know with us. That would be 5 million each. What would I do with 5 million pounds, I wonder? I need new patio doors. They're about 15,000, though Ron knows someone who could do it for 8. I could buy $14.99 wine instead of $8.99 wine, but would I notice the difference? Give some money to Joanna? She already has plenty. I used to give her £20 when she went out with friends and her eyes would light up. I loved that. Would they light up the same way for £1 million? Probably not. She'd probably put it in an ISA or something. So I probably don't really need £5 million, but nonetheless, I'm sure I shall dream about it tonight. You would too, wouldn't you?
Chapter 33. They had told her to pack a small suitcase, that she needed to come with them. It was already packed. The officers would be expecting tears, but she couldn't make the tears come. Would they judge her? Would they think she didn't love Poppy, that she was a bad mother? Siobhan supposed that they'd seen every sort of reaction possible in their time. She should just be herself, whoever that was now. The journey seemed long, but Siobhan couldn't sleep. The two officers talked a little in the car. Was she okay?
No, not really.
Did she need anything? If they meant a drink or a snack, then no, she didn't. Was she up to doing the identification tonight? Well, she honestly had no idea. They repeated their condolences a number of times, and she thanked them each time. They reached Godalming just after midnight. Despite the lateness of the hour, they passed a van on the long driveway, travelling in the opposite direction, away from the house. Sue Reardon and Lance James had introduced themselves. They were both polite, but then what alternative did they have? Sue was exactly as she had expected, exactly the type she had pictured. And now they are walking down a long corridor in a building that must once have been stables. Lance is leading the way. You can see he doesn't know what to say. She would be the same. Sue Reardon has slipped her arm through Siobhan's, which can't be standard procedure, but there was a time for standard procedure, and this was not it. Siobhan is grateful for the gesture. She knows what lies ahead.
what must be done. Lance takes out a key card and opens a large metal door, knocking on it as it opens. A blast of chill air bends around the door and into the corridor. Sue Reardon stops for a moment and looks Siobhan in the eyes. Are you ready? Siobhan nods. I'm here if you need me. Sue lets Siobhan walk into the room first, and she shivers as the cold air envelops her. The room is small and functional. There are two long tables, and a shrouded figure lies on each. The figure on the left must be Poppy, because there is a doctor standing beside it. At least Siobhan assumes it's a doctor. She is wearing a white coat and surgical gloves and a mask. She has kind eyes, and that almost makes Siobhan cry for the first time. She doesn't need kindness at the moment. Lance rests against the far wall, a man in a room in which he does not want to be. Siobhan sees that he reflexively starts to rub his hands together for warmth, but thinks better of it and plants them behind his back instead. Sue's hand is at her elbow. This is Dr. Carter, Siobhan. Dr. Carter nods at Siobhan, and Siobhan has to look away from the kind eyes. I'm afraid your daughter has traumatic injuries. I would ask you to prepare yourself. Siobhan nods. Here goes. Dr. Carter pulls back the pale green sheet covering the body, and as the unruly blonde hair begins to spill out, Siobhan knows she has to shut a part of herself down, a part she may never get back. There was little of the face left, but enough. Enough for a mother to tell her own daughter. Siobhan turns back to Sue and nods. It's Poppy. Siobhan starts to cry now. She knew it would come. Nobody should have to do this. Sue places a hand on her shoulder. Siobhan, I just need to ask you a couple of other questions. Because of the injuries, any other distinguishing features you could tell us? Siobhan gulps in air. She has a long scar on the back of her left calf, barbed wire on the Isle of Wight. And her left wrist has a lump. She broke it playing hockey. And the stupid tattoo. Sue looks over to Dr. Carter, who nods. Thank you, Siobhan, says Sue. Would you like to spend a bit more time here? No one is in a rush. Siobhan doesn't want to turn back to see the body lying there. She has seen enough. Has an image to last her until her dying day. Or we can go somewhere warm, have a cup of tea. Siobhan nods through her tears. She turns back to the body. Dr. Carter has pulled the sheet back over Poppy's face. The blonde hair still peeks out. Siobhan gently reaches out her hand and strokes a loose strand. Lance, Sue, and Dr. Carter all stay quiet as Siobhan strokes the blonde hair and weeps. Traumatic injuries, thinks Siobhan. Well, that's the truth. Siobhan takes her hand away and Sue puts an arm around her. Let's get you out of here, says Sue. Siobhan looks over to the figure on the other table. And that's the other one? That's Douglas? Yes, says Sue, that's Douglas. And some poor soul has to come in and identify him too? Sue shakes her head. Fortunately not, no next of kin, so fingerprints, dental records, whatever we have on file. Well, God bless him, I suppose, says Siobhan.
and Sue leads her out of the room. Chapter 34. Elizabeth is rearranging some of the ornaments the MI5 team have misplaced during their search of the flat. She prefers everything in its place. The Delft fisherman Stephen had bought from a Bruges flea market, sitting next to Penny's police badge, sitting next to the shattered Soviet shell casing Elizabeth had dug from the radiator of her Triumph Herald after a misunderstanding in Prague in 1973. So many memories. Her latest memento, Douglas's locket, is in her bag and will be staying there. Elizabeth was surprised that Sue had let her take it away. Surely it was evidence. Though once they checked it for a hidden message, she supposes Sue thought it was harmless enough. It was kind of her to let Elizabeth keep it. She hadn't seen it for 30-odd years, could barely remember it if she was honest. When Sue had taken it out, she had tried to remember what was inside it. A lock of hair? A picture of Douglas smoking rakishly? But no, the mirror, of course. When had he given it to her? Back in London, she thinks. An anniversary? Or had she caught Douglas cheating? Either way, he had bought her the locket. Not inexpensive, he had revealed, and the mirror was purest flummery. It feels unfair, he had said, that I have the benefit of looking at your beautiful face any time I wish. So I wanted you to see what I see. Elizabeth had scoffed, she was sure of that, but nonetheless was touched. She had left the locket behind when she had left Douglas behind and had not thought of it since. Why on earth had he kept it? And why on earth had it been in his jacket when he died? Was this really what he wanted to show her? He was always one for a romantic gesture. Was this a final act of love? The first thing she had done when she arrived home was, of course, to prise the mirror out with a screwdriver. There would be a hidden message behind it, she was sure of that. The location of the diamonds, well, that really would be a final act of love, thank you, Douglas. But there was nothing behind the mirror. No treasure map, no hidden code. So the locket was just a locket, after all. And the act of love was just that. An act of love. Douglas never failed to surprise her. Before she was loaded into the back of the van in Hove, Elizabeth had used Joyce's phone to message Bogdan. Without hesitation, Bogdan had come and looked after Stephen for the night. Had he cancelled something important? Elizabeth has no idea what Bogdan does when he is not at work. Clearly he spends some time at the gym and at the tattooist, but, other than that, he is a mystery. Elizabeth is thinking about Martin Lomax. It is obvious that he killed Douglas and Poppy, surely. Too obvious? Perhaps they should just pop up to see him. If the secret wasn't in the locket, they were going to have to start their search somewhere. Stephen is asleep and Bogdan is sitting patiently by the chessboard. At first he was asleep, you know, Stephen, says Bogdan. But then they needed to search your room, so I woke him up.
And he was fine about it?
Asked Elizabeth. She weighs up Penny's badge in her hand, her most recent memento.
Oh, he loved it, says Bogdan. Asking what they were looking for, helping them to look, telling stories.
They tied it up very nicely, says Elizabeth.
Well, I had to help a bit, says Bogdan. And so what were they looking for, can you tell me?
Oh, they were looking for my phone. They wanted to see the message Douglas had sent me. But I'd taken some pictures of the corpses and I didn't want to lose them. Elizabeth had filled Bogdan in on the deaths of Douglas and Poppy. Bogdan had nodded at length and said, I see.
Yes, you never know when you might need pictures of corpses, agrees Bogdan. But your phone isn't here. They looked in a lot of places.
No, it's behind a loose brick in a low wall outside 41 St. Albans Avenue, Hove, says Elizabeth. You wouldn't be a dear and go and fetch it for me later, would you?
Of course, says Bogdan.
And you'll remember the address?
Of course, says Bogdan. I remember everything.
Thank you, says Elizabeth.
And I gave Ron the cocaine by the pier, like you asked.
You really are a good sort, Bogdan, says Elizabeth.
He's a terrific sort, says Stephen, waking, looking at the board and moving his bishop. Giving Ron cocaine by the pier, quite right too.
Bogdan looks down at the board.
Forgive me, boys, says Elizabeth. I have a call to make. Bogdan, I'll also need you to drive me to meet an international money launderer today if you're free.
I can be free for that, says Bogdan.
She walks through to the bedroom. The bed is perfectly made. Given that Stephen had gone back to sleep after MI5 had been by, it could only have been made by Bogdan. She picks up the landline and dials Chris Hudson's number. He picks up on the fifth ring, slow for him.
DCI Chris Hudson?
Chris, it's Elizabeth. Just checking in on Ryan Baird. I wondered if there had been any developments in the case.
You wondered if perhaps we'd found cocaine and a bank card in his toilet.
That sort of thing.
He's been charged with possession with intent to supply and robbery.
Well, isn't that opportune? You and Donna can tell us all about it tomorrow. There's wine at Joyce's.
Ah, I can't tomorrow. I'm working.
No, you're not, Chris. I checked.
How did you check?
No, don't answer.
Okay, sorry. I'm busy tomorrow.
Elizabeth hears a woman's voice in the background saying, "Is that Elizabeth? Well, 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 this must be the mystery girlfriend." None of them liked to pry, of course, but it had been a month or so now, and they had yet to be introduced.
Elizabeth thinks quickly. How to play this? Joyce will be furious if she doesn't get as much information as possible.
Oh, that's fine. What are you up to? Anything nice? Drinks with friends?
Just a quiet night. Wait a moment.
Chris puts his hand over the mouthpiece and she hears him ask a muffled question. It sounds like, "Are you sure?"
Hello?
A female voice comes on the line.
Is this Elizabeth?
This is Elizabeth, yes, says Elizabeth.
To whom am I speaking?
I'm Patrice, Chris's girlfriend. More lady friend, if I'm honest. What age does that change? I'm afraid Chris and I have plans for tomorrow, but another time, perhaps?
Well, another time would be lovely, Patrice. How nice to finally speak to you.
And you, Elizabeth, I have heard a lot about you.
Well, I wish I could say the same, but mystery is very important, isn't it?
Elizabeth is trying to place the accent. South London? It's a little like Donna's.
Isn't it? Says Patrice. We might keep our mystery for a bit longer, if that's okay. Lovely to chat to you, though.
And to you, dear. Say goodbye to Chris for me.
I will do. See you soon, I'm sure.
Patrice puts the phone down and Elizabeth looks at the handset for a moment. She has been put in her place and she approves. This is exactly the sort of woman Chris needs in his life. And if she likes Chris and if Chris likes her, then Elizabeth would like to meet her. Could Donna help, maybe? Persuade them both to come to Joyce's? Give Patrice a couple of glasses of wine, really get to know her? Vetting, they used to call it in the service.
Stephen pops his head round the door. A gang of your lot here last night, I meant to say, spooks all over the place after this, that or the other.
I know, sorry about that, dear,
Oh, not a bit of it. It was wonderful. Whatever they wanted, they didn't find it. I told them, if Elizabeth doesn't want you to find something, you won't find it. Simple as that. Don't waste your time. She could hide Christmas presents in a rowing boat. I didn't know where you'd gone. I thought the shops. But it was very late. Joyce and I were up chatting. I told them any time. Open door to spooks round here. What was it? Somebody murdered? Two people murdered. Spies? Yes. Wonderful. Now, what was I doing, dear? Playing chess with Bogdan. Oh, good. He made me scrambled eggs. And he gave Ron cocaine. What a champ. I'll get back to him. I'll leave you to your murdered spies. Two murdered spies. Two murdered spies. Elizabeth picks up the phone and rings Chris Hudson again. This time, it takes him even longer to answer. 7 rings. Just long enough for a whispered argument about whether to answer it. He obviously recognises her landline now. Yes, Elizabeth, says Chris. Oh, hello, Chris, says Elizabeth. I'm sorry. Could you put Patrice on? Patrice? Yes, please, dear, no offence. There is a pause, a hand over the mouthpiece once again, and another muffled chat. Hello, Elizabeth, says Patrice. Hello, dear. I'm sorry to bother you again. I don't know what you're doing tomorrow. Agreed, says Patrice. And I don't want to know, of course, your business, but I'm about to tell you something I haven't told Chris yet. I'll give you 30 seconds, Elizabeth. I was being massaged. Oh, good for Chris, says Elizabeth. Here's my pitch, dear. Yesterday afternoon, 2 spies were shot dead in a house in Hove. I was there. It won't be a police matter. It has gone straight to MI5. But I would love to talk to Chris about it and get his take. And I just thought that if you wanted to come over with him, perhaps tomorrow evening, you sound the sort of person who might be interested in the details of 2 spies being murdered. I have pictures and everything, and there will be wine, and I know everyone would be thrilled to meet you. As I say, I don't know your plans. Well, we were going to Zizi's. Nearly got her, thinks Elizabeth. How to close the deal, though? And one of the spies who was murdered just happened to be my ex-husband. Okay, says Patrice. We'll bring a bottle. Elizabeth hears Patrice call away from the phone. We're seeing Elizabeth tomorrow, babes. And hears Chris's reply. Well, of course we are. Shall we say 6:30? Says Elizabeth. And could you ask Chris to invite Donna too? Donna? Asks Patrice. Yes, wouldn't be the same without her. I'm assuming you've met Donna. Oh, yes, I've met Donna, says Patrice, once or twice. See you tomorrow, dear, says Elizabeth and puts down the phone. So, Patrice has already met Donna. Must be serious. Right. On to Martin Lomax. Chapter 35. Martin Lomax takes the tray of coffee and biscuits down to his home cinema. 20 leather seats all angled towards the screen, which takes up an entire wall. The most people he has ever had in here was 4 when the Azerbaijani Cup final coincided with a particularly profitable heroin deal. Martin Lomax had brought them down nibbles and everybody seemed to have a good time. Lomax didn't really understand much about having a good time, but he was good at blending in and not spoiling things for other people. When there was money to be made, at least. He points the remote control at the screen and brings up his library of movies. Martin Lomax can't see the point in films at all. It's just some people acting. How could everyone not see that? Someone writes some words, some idiots from America say them, and it seems to send everybody cuckoo. Lomax had gone to the theatre once, and that seemed marginally better. At least the actors were there. At least you could talk to them when you disagreed. He had been asked to leave, but he certainly wouldn't rule out going again one day. He scrolls past countless films he will never watch, although he knows lots of the titles by now. He finally reaches another film he will never watch. It is called The Treasure of the Sierra Madre, and you can tell by the picture that it is black and white. Black and white? People really were fools. He selects the film and then navigates down through the menu until he finds subtitles. A list of languages appears and Martin Lomax scrolls down until he finds Cantonese. He selects it. He immediately hears those three familiar electronic beeps and the cinema screen disappears up into the ceiling. Painted on the wall behind is a rainbow. Martin Lomax places his fingertips at either end of the rainbow. There are three more electronic beeps and a door slides open. Martin Lomax picks up his tray and walks into the vault. Martin Lomax often likes to have his coffee and biscuits in the vault. It is lovely and cool so as not to damage any of the banknotes or the priceless paintings that are rolled up against the far wall. He has just received his first Banksy, and he is unimpressed. It is a rat looking at a mobile phone. Why would a rat be looking at a mobile phone? Modern art is beyond Lomax. But he bets Banksy would be delighted to know his work is now valuable enough to be used as a down payment on an international arms deal. The man who had dropped it off, a Chechen, had said that Banksy's real name was a secret, but he told him what it was regardless. Lomax has already forgotten it. Art was a racket. Give him gold any day of the week. You didn't have to understand gold. The vault is also very quiet, thanks to the 6-foot-thick walls surrounding him. You could easily kill someone in here, and, in fact, that did happen once. It caused quite a kerfuffle at the time. Lomax dunks a chocolate chip cookie in his coffee. The Open Garden Week starts today. What will people think of the grounds? Too ornate? Too cultivated? Not cultivated enough? Would it rain? Google says there is a 0% chance, but how could it possibly know? Would people come? Would they buy his brownies? Would anybody try and get into the house? They would soon discover it was impossible, but what if they got close enough to see all the lasers and the tiny cameras in the hanging baskets? He will leave a comments book outside the pagoda, and he can spend Monday looking through it. Will people write their names? Perhaps he will leave a space for people's addresses, too. If anyone leaves an unpleasant comment, he can send someone to pay them a visit. Lomax sips at his coffee, noticing a couple of cookie crumbs floating on the surface. The coffee is Colombian, as was the man who was shot in the vault with a bolt gun that time. The man's boss, who had done the shooting, and presumably had his own reasons, had asked Lomax if he might bury the body in the gardens, but Lomax had quite enough buried there already, and so had politely said no. The boss had been understanding, and Lomax had helped drag the body out to his helicopter by way of an apology. If Lomax sells all of his brownies, then he thinks he will be able to raise £70. He wonders what he will spend it on. On the whole, Martin Lomax enjoys his job. It is lucrative, and while money isn't everything, far from it, Martin Lomax has been poor and he's been rich, and he prefers rich. There is variety, no 2 days are the same, and that is psychologically healthy.
One day will run smoothly, you'll return some gold bullion to a Bulgarian and everyone is smiles and handshakes. Then the next day, there's a car bomb in Kabul and person Y is cutting off person X's fingers and everyone wants their money or their paintings or their racehorse and Martin Lomax is rushed off his feet. It certainly keeps his mind active. Best of all, though, he gets to work from home. Everyone knows that. Martin Lomax won't come to Monte Carlo or Beirut or Qatar or Buenos Aires. Martin Lomax won't even travel to the Winchester M&S if he can avoid it. No, you come to Martin Lomax, whether you're a warlord, whether you're a trafficker, or whether you're a cardo. But sometimes, not often, touch wood, the job is stressful. And this is one of those times. He flips open his laptop and rings the number he has been sent on his encrypted phone. Frank Andrade Jr., the second in command of one of New York's leading crime families. Lomax knows that if the conversation goes badly, the next person he will be speaking to is Frank's father, who, from memory, is also called Frank. And if that happens, then Martin Lomax really would have to travel, probably against his will, in the hold of a private jet. The Americans want to know what has happened to their £20 million worth of diamonds. Of course they do, that's natural. Martin Lomax doesn't suppose the value matters all that much to them. They can afford to misplace the odd 20 million every now and again. It is more the issue of trust. Martin Lomax has provided an invaluable service for a long time now, and he has provided it with skill and discretion. He has been a well-oiled cog in the wheels of these huge organizations, beyond reproach and above suspicion. But now, Andrade's face fills the screen suddenly, and he immediately begins to remonstrate with Lomax, his arms windmilling. He brings a fist down on his New York desk. "Frank, you're on mute, I think," says Martin Lomax. "You need to click on the little microphone, the green button." Frank Andrade leans into his screen, mouth open and eyes scanning for the button. He presses it. "Can you hear me?" "That's